immediately before a formal ceasefire to fire any remaining ammunition at each other. The spirit of the thing was, kill as many of them as you can while you can. Wandering around near the Suez Canal and sensing an incoming missile, Amos leapt into a trench and landed on top of an Israeli soldier. "Are you a bomb?" asked the terrified soldier.
"No, I'm Amos," said Amos.
"So I'm not dead?" asked the soldier.
"You're not dead," said Amos.
That was the one story Amos told. Apart from that, he seldom mentioned the war again. In late 1973 or early 1974, Danny gave a talk which he would deliver more than once and which he called Cognitive Limitations and Public Decision-Making. "It was troubling to consider," he began, "an organism equipped with an effective and hormonal system not much different from that of the jungle rat being given the ability to destroy every living thing by pushing a few buttons." Given the work on human judgment that he and Amos had just finished, he found it further troubling to think that crucial decisions are made, today as thousands of years ago, in terms of the intuitive guesses and preferences of a few men in positions of authority. The failure of decision-makers to grapple with the inner workings of their own minds and their desire to indulge their gut feelings made it quite likely that the fate of entire societies may be sealed by a series of avoidable mistakes committed by their leaders. Before the war, Danny and Amos had shared the hope that their work on human judgment would find its way into high-stakes real-world decision-making. In this new field called decision analysis, they could transform high-stakes decision-making into a sort of engineering problem. They would design decision-making systems. Experts on decision-making would sit with leaders in business, the military, and government, and help them to frame every decision explicitly as a gamble, to calculate the odds of this or that happening, and to assign values to every possible outcome. If we seed the hurricane, there is a 50% chance we lower its wind speed, but a 5% chance that we lull people who really should evacuate into a false sense of security. What do we do? In the bargain, the decision analysts would remind important decision makers that their gut feelings had mysterious powers to steer them wrong. The general change in our culture toward numerical formulations will give room for explicit reference to uncertainty, Amos wrote in notes to himself for a talk of his own. Both Amos and Danny thought that voters and shareholders and all the other people who lived with the consequences of high-level decisions might come to develop a better understanding of the nature of decision-making. They would learn to evaluate a decision not by its outcomes, whether it turned out to be right or wrong, but by the process that led to it. The job of the decision-maker wasn't to be right, but to figure out the odds in any decision and play them well. As Danny told audiences in Israel, what was needed was a transformation of cultural attitudes to uncertainty and to risk. Exactly how some decision analyst would persuade any business, military, or political leader to allow him to edit his thinking was unclear. How would you even persuade some important decision maker to assign numbers to his utilities? Important people didn't want their gut feelings pinned down, even by themselves. And that was the rub. Later, Danny recalled the moment he and Amos lost faith in decision analysis. The failure of Israeli intelligence to anticipate the Yom Kippur attack led to an upheaval in the Israeli government and a subsequent brief period of introspection. They'd won the war, but the outcome felt like a loss. The Egyptians, who had suffered even greater losses, were celebrating in the streets as if they had won, while everyone in Israel was trying to figure out what had gone wrong. Before the war, the Israeli intelligence unit had insisted, despite a lot of evidence to the contrary, that Egypt would never attack Israel so long as Israel maintained air superiority. Israel had maintained air superiority, and yet Egypt had attacked. After the war, with the view that perhaps it could do better, Israel's Ministry of Foreign Affairs set up its own intelligence unit. The man in charge of it, Zvi Lanier, sought Danny's help. In the end, Danny and Lanier conducted an elaborate exercise in decision analysis. Its basic idea was to introduce a new rigor in dealing with questions of national security. "We started with the idea that we should get rid of the usual intelligence report," said Danny. "Intelligence reports are in the form of essays, and essays have the characteristic that they can be understood any way you damn well please." In place of the essay, Danny wanted to give Israel's leaders probabilities in numerical form. In 1974, U.S. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger had served as the middleman in peace negotiations between Israel and Egypt and between Israel and Syria. As a prod to action, Kissinger had sent the Israeli government the CIA's assessment that if the attempt to make peace failed, very bad events were likely to follow. Danny and Lanier set out to give Israeli Foreign Minister Yigal Alon precise numerical estimates of the likelihood of some very specific bad things happening. They assembled a list of possible critical events or concerns, regime change in Jordan, U.S. recognition of the Palestine Liberation Organization, another full-scale war with Syria, and so on. Then they surveyed experts and well-informed observers to establish the likelihood of each event. Among these people, they found a remarkable consensus. There wasn't a lot of disagreement about the odds. When Danny asked the experts what the effect might be of the failure of Kissinger's negotiations on the probability of war with Syria, for instance, their answers clustered around, raises the chance of war by 10%. Danny and Lanier then presented their probabilities to Israel's foreign ministry. The National Gamble, they called their report. Foreign Minister Alon looked at the numbers and said, 10% increase? That is a small difference. Danny was stunned. If a 10% increase in the chances of full-scale war with Syria wasn't enough to interest Alon in Kissinger's peace process, how much would it take to turn his head? That number represented the best estimate of the odds. Apparently, the foreign minister didn't want to rely on the best estimates. He preferred his own internal probability calculator, his gut. That was the moment I gave up on decision analysis, said Danny. No one ever made a decision because of a number. They need a story. As Danny and Lanier wrote decades later, after the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency asked them to describe their experience in decision analysis, the Israeli Foreign Ministry was indifferent to the specific probabilities. What was the point of laying out the odds of a gamble if the person taking it either didn't believe the numbers or didn't want to know them? The trouble, Danny suspected, was that the understanding of numbers is so weak that they don't communicate anything. Everyone feels that those probabilities are not real, that they are just something on somebody's mind. In the history of Danny and Amos, there are periods when it is difficult to disentangle their enthusiasm for their ideas from their enthusiasm for each other. The moments before and after the Yom Kippur War appear, in hindsight, less like a natural progression from one idea to the next than two men in love scrambling to find an excuse to be together. They felt they were finished exploring the errors that arose from the rules of thumb people used to evaluate probabilities in any uncertain situation. They found decision analysis promising, but ultimately futile. They went back and forth on writing a general interest book about the various ways the human mind deals with uncertainty. For some reason, they could never get beyond a sketchy outline and false starts of a few chapters. After the Yom Kippur War and the ensuing collapse of the public's faith in the judgment of Israeli government officials, they thought that what they really should do was reform the educational system so that future leaders were taught how to think. We have attempted to teach people to be aware of the pitfalls and fallacies of their own reasoning, they wrote, in a passage for the popular book that never came to be. We have attempted to teach people at various levels in government, army, etc., but achieved only limited success. Adult minds were too self-deceptive. Children's minds were a different matter. Danny created a course in judgment for elementary school children. Amos briefly taught a similar class to high school students, and they put together a book proposal. We found these experiences highly encouraging, they wrote. If they could teach Israeli kids how to think, how to detect their own seductive but misleading intuition and to correct for it, who knew where it might lead? Perhaps one day, those children would grow up to see the wisdom of encouraging Henry Kissinger's next efforts to make peace between Israel and Syria. But this, too, they never followed through on. They never went broad. It was as if the temptation to address the public interfered with their interest in each other's minds. Instead, Amos invited Danny to explore the question that had kept Amos interested in psychology. How did people make decisions? One day, Amos just said, "We're finished with judgment. Let's do decision-making," recalled Danny. The distinction between judgment and decision-making appeared as fuzzy as the distinction between judgment and prediction. But to Amos, as to other mathematical psychologists, they were distinct fields of inquiry. A person making a judgment was assigning odds,
How likely is it that that guy will be a good NBA player? How risky is that AAA-rated subprime mortgage-backed CDO? Is the shadow on the X-ray cancer? Not every judgment is followed by a decision, but every decision implies some judgment. The field of decision-making explored what people did after they had formed some judgment, after they knew the odds, or thought they knew the odds, or perhaps had judged the odds unknowable. Do I pick that player? Do I buy that CDO? Surgery or chemotherapy? It sought to understand how people acted when faced with risky options. Students of decision-making had more or less given up on real-world investigations and reduced the field to the study of hypothetical gambles, made by subjects in a lab in which the odds were explicitly stated. Hypothetical gambles played the same role in the study of decision-making that the fruit fly played in the study of genetics. They served as proxies for phenomena impossible to isolate in the real world. To introduce Danny to his field, Danny knew nothing about it, Amos gave him an undergraduate textbook on mathematical psychology that he had written with his teacher Clyde Coombs and another Coombs student, Robin Dawes, the researcher who had confidently and incorrectly guessed computer scientist when Danny handed him the Tom W. sketch in Oregon. Then he directed Danny to a very long chapter called Individual Decision-Making. The history of decision theory, the textbook explained to Danny, began in the early 18th century, with dice-rolling French noblemen asking court mathematicians to help them figure out how to gamble. The expected value of a gamble was the sum of its outcomes, each weighted by the probability of its occurring. If someone offers you a coin flip and you win $100 if the coin lands on heads but lose $50 if it lands on tails, the expected value is $100 times 0.5 plus minus $50 times 0.5, or $25. If you follow the rule that you take any bet with a positive expected value, you take the bet. But anyone with eyes could see that people, when they made bets, didn't always act as if they were seeking to maximize their expected value. Gamblers accepted bets with negative expected values. If they didn't, casinos wouldn't exist. And people bought insurance, paying premiums that exceeded their expected losses. If they didn't, insurance companies would have no viable business. Any theory pretending to explain how a rational person should take risks must at least take into account the common human desire to buy insurance, and other cases in which people systematically fail to maximize expected value. The major theory of decision-making, Amos's textbook explained, had been published in the 1730s by a Swiss mathematician named Daniel Bernoulli. Bernoulli sought to account a bit better than simple calculations of expected value for how people actually behaved. Let us suppose a pauper happens to acquire a lottery ticket by which he may, with equal probability, win either nothing or 20,000 ducats, he wrote, back when a ducat was a ducat. Will he have to evaluate the worth of the ticket as 10,000 ducats, or would he be acting foolishly if he sold it for 9,000 ducats? To explain why a pauper would prefer 9,000 ducats to a 50-50 chance to win 20,000, Bernoulli resorted to sleight of hand. People didn't maximize value, he said. They maximized utility. What was a person's utility? That odd, off-putting word here meant something like the value a person assigns to money. Well, that depended on how much money the person had to begin with. But a pauper holding a lottery ticket with an expected value of 10,000 ducats would certainly experience greater utility from 9,000 ducats in cash. People will choose whatever they most want is not all that helpful as a theory to predict human behavior. What saved expected utility theory, as it came to be called, from being so general as to be meaningless, were its assumptions about human nature. To his assumption that people making decisions sought to maximize utility, Bernoulli added an assumption that people were risk-averse. Amos's textbook defined risk aversion this way: the more money one has, the less he values each additional increment, or, equivalently, that the utility of any additional dollar diminishes with an increase in capital. You value the second $1,000 you get your hands on a bit less than you do the first $1,000, just as you value the third $1,000 a bit less than the second $1,000. The marginal value of the dollars you give up to buy fire insurance on your house is less than the marginal value of the dollars you lose if your house burns down, which is why, even though the insurance is, strictly speaking, a stupid bet, you buy it. You place less value on the $1,000 you stand to win flipping a coin than you do on the $1,000 already in your bank account that you stand to lose, and so you reject the bet. A pauper places so much value on the first 9,000 ducats he gets his hands on that the risk of not having them overwhelms the temptation to gamble, at favorable odds, for more. This was not to say that real people in the real world behaved as they did because they had the traits Bernoulli ascribed to them, only that the theory seemed to describe some of what people did in the real world with real money. It explained the desire to buy insurance. It distinctly did not explain the human desire to buy a lottery ticket, however. It effectively turned a blind eye to gambling. Odd this, as the search for a theory about how people made risky decisions had started as an attempt to make Frenchmen shrewder gamblers. Amos's text skipped over the long, tortured history of utility theory after Bernoulli all the way to 1944. A Hungarian Jew named John von Neumann and an Austrian anti-Semite named Oskar Morgenstern, both of whom fled Europe for America, somehow came together that year to publish what might be called the Rules of Rationality. A rational person making a decision between risky propositions, for instance, shouldn't violate the von Neumann and Morgenstern transitivity axiom. If he preferred A to B and B to C, then he should prefer A to C. Anyone who preferred A to B and B to C but then turned around and preferred C to A violated expected utility theory. Among the remaining rules, maybe the most critical given what would come, was what von Neumann and Morgenstern called the independence axiom. This rule said that a choice between two gambles shouldn't be changed by the introduction of some irrelevant alternative. For example, you walk into a deli to get a sandwich, and the man behind the counter says he has only roast beef and turkey. You choose turkey. As he makes your sandwich, he looks up and says, "Oh, yeah, I forgot, I have ham." And you say, "Oh, then I'll take the roast beef." Von Neumann and Morgenstern's axiom said, in effect, that you can't be considered rational if you switch from turkey to roast beef just because they found some ham in the back. And really, who would switch? Like the other rules of rationality, the independence axiom seemed reasonable and not obviously contradicted by the way human beings generally behaved. Expected utility theory was just a theory. It didn't pretend to be able to explain or predict everything people did when they faced some risky decision. Danny gleaned its importance not from reading Amos's description of it in the undergraduate textbook, but only from the way Amos spoke of it. "This was a sacred thing for Amos," said Danny. Although the theory made no great claim to psychological truth, the textbook Amos had co-authored made it clear that it had been accepted as psychologically true. Pretty much everyone interested in such things, a group that included the entire economics profession, seemed to take it as a fair description of how ordinary people faced with risky alternatives actually went about making choices. That leap of faith had at least one obvious implication for the sort of advice economists gave to political leaders. It tilted everything in the direction of giving people the freedom to choose and leaving markets alone. After all, if people could be counted on to be basically rational, markets could too. Amos had clearly wondered about that, even as a Michigan graduate student. Amos had always had an almost jungle instinct for the vulnerability of other people's ideas. He, of course, knew that people made decisions that the theory would not have predicted. Amos himself had explored how people could be, as the theory assumed they were not, reliably intransitive. As a graduate student in Michigan, he had induced both Harvard undergraduates and convicted murderers in Michigan prisons over and over again to choose gamble A over gamble B, then choose gamble B over gamble C, and then turn around and choose C instead of A. That violated a rule of expected utility theory, and yet Amos had never followed his doubts very far. He saw that people sometimes made mistakes. He did not see anything systematically irrational in the way they made decisions. He hadn't figured out how to bring deep insights about human nature into the mathematical study of human decision-making. By the summer of 1973, Amos was searching for ways to undo the reigning theory of decision-making, just as he and Danny had undone the idea that human judgment followed the precepts of statistical theory. On a trip to Europe with his friend Paul Slovic, he shared his latest thoughts about how to make room, in the world of decision theory, for a messier view of human nature. Amos warns against pitting utility theory versus an alternative model in a direct head-to-head empirical test, Slovic relayed in a letter to a colleague in September 1973. "The problem is that utility theory is so general that it is hard to refute. Our strategy should be to take the offensive in building a case, not against utility theory, but for an alternative conception that brings man's limitations in as a constraint. Amos had at his disposal a connoisseur of man's limitations. He now described Danny as the world's greatest living psychologist. Not that he ever said anything so flattering to Danny directly. Manly reticence was the rule, said Danny. He never fully explained to Danny why he thought to invite him into decision theory, a technical and antiseptic field Danny cared little about and knew less of. But it is hard to believe that Amos was simply looking around for something else they might do together. It's easier to believe that Amos suspected what might happen after he gave Danny his textbook on the subject. That moment has the feel of an old episode of The Three Stooges, when Larry plays Pop Goes the Weasel and triggers Curly into a frenzy of destruction. Danny read Amos's textbook the way he might have read a recipe written in Martian. He decoded it. He had long ago realized that he wasn't a natural applied mathematician, but he could follow the logic of the equations. He knew that he was meant to respect, even revere them. Amos was a member of high standing in the Society of Mathematical Psychologists. That society, in turn, looked down upon much of the rest of psychology. It is a given that people who use mathematics have some glamour, said Danny. It was prestigious because it borrowed the aura of mathematics and because nobody else could understand what was going on there. Danny couldn't escape the growing prestige of math and the social sciences. His remove counted against him, but he didn't really admire decision theory or care about it. He cared why people behaved as they did, and to Danny's way of thinking, the major theory of decision-making did not begin to describe how people made decisions. It must have come as something of a relief to him, as he neared the end of Amos's chapter on expected utility theory, to arrive at the following sentence. Some people, however, remained unconvinced by the axioms. One such person, the textbook went on to say, was Maurice Allais. Allais was a French economist who disliked the self-certainty of American economists. He especially disapproved of the growing tendency in economics, after von Neumann and Morgenstern built their theory, to treat a math model of human behavior as an accurate description of how people made choices. At a convention of economists in 1953, Allais offered what he imagined to be a killer argument against expected utility theory. He asked his audience to imagine their choices in the following two situations. The dollar amounts used by Allais are here multiplied by 10 to account for inflation and capture the feel of his original problem. Situation 1. You must choose between having $5 million for sure or this gamble. 2. An 89% chance of winning $5 million, a 10% chance of winning $25 million, a 1% chance to win zero. Most people who looked at that, apparently including many of the American economists in Allais's audience, said, obviously I'll take door number one, the $5 million for sure. They preferred the certainty of being rich to the slim possibility of being even richer. To which Allais replied, okay, now consider the second situation. Situation 2, you must choose between having 3, an 11% chance of winning $5 million with an 89% chance to win zero, or 4. A 10% chance of winning $25 million with a 90% chance to win zero. Most everyone, including American economists, looked at this choice and said, I'll take number 4. They preferred the slightly lower chance of winning a lot more money. There was nothing wrong with this. On the face of it, both choices felt perfectly sensible. The trouble, as Amos's textbook explained, was that this seemingly innocent pair of preferences is incompatible with utility theory. What was now called the Allais paradox had become the most famous contradiction of expected utility theory. Allais's problem caused even the most cold-blooded American economist to violate the rules of rationality. Amos's introduction to mathematical psychology sketched the controversy and argument that had ensued after Allais posed his paradox. On the American end, the argument was spearheaded by a brilliant American statistician and mathematician named L.J. Jimmy Savage, who had made important contributions to utility theory, and who admitted that he, too, had been suckered by Allais into contradicting himself. Savage found an even more complicated way to restate Allais's gambles so that at least a few devotees of expected utility theory, himself included, looked at the second situation and picked option number 3 instead of option number 4. That is, he demonstrated, or thought he had demonstrated, that the Allais paradox was not a paradox at all, and that people behaved just as expected utility predicted they would behave. Amos, along with pretty much everyone else who took an interest in such things, remained dubious. As Danny read up on decision theory, Amos helped him to understand what was important about it and what was not. He just had impeccable taste, said Danny. He knew what the problems were. He knew how to situate himself in the broad field. I didn't have that. What was important, Amos said, were the unresolved puzzles. Amos said, "This is the story. This is the game. The game is to solve the Allais paradox." Danny wasn't inclined to see the paradox as a problem of logic. It looked to him more like a quirk in human behavior. "I wanted to understand the psychology of what was going on," he said. He sensed that Allais himself hadn't given much thought to why people might choose in a way that violated the major theory of decision-making. But to Danny, the reason seemed obvious: regret. In the first situation, people sensed that they would look back on their decision if it turned out badly and feel they had screwed up. In the second situation, not so much. Anyone who turned down a certain gift of $5 million would experience far more regret if he wound up with nothing than a person who turned down a gamble in which he stood a slight chance of winning $5 million. If people mostly choose option one, it was because they sensed the special pain they would experience if they chose option two and won nothing. Avoiding that pain became a line item on the inner calculation of their expected utility. Regret was the ham in the back of the deli that caused people to switch from turkey to roast beef. Decision theory had approached the seeming contradiction at the heart of the Allais paradox as a technical problem. Danny found that silly. There was no contradiction. It was just psychology. The understanding of any decision had to account not just for the financial consequences, but for the emotional ones, too. Obviously, it is not regret itself that determines decisions, no more than the actual emotional response to consequences ever determines the prior choice of a course of action, Danny wrote to Amos in one of a series of memos on the subject. It is the anticipation of regret that affects decisions, along with the anticipation of other consequences. Danny thought that people anticipated regret and adjusted for it in a way they did not anticipate or adjust for other emotions. "What might have been is an essential component of misery," he wrote to Amos. "There is an asymmetry here because considerations of how much worse things could have been is not a salient factor in human joy and happiness." Happy people did not dwell on some imagined unhappiness the way unhappy people imagined what they might have done differently so that they might be happy. People did not seek to avoid other emotions with the same energy they sought to avoid regret. When they made decisions, people did not seek to maximize utility. They sought to minimize regret. As the starting point for a new theory, it sounded promising. When people asked Amos how he made the big decisions in his life, he often told them that his strategy was to imagine what he would come to regret after he had chosen some option, and to choose the option that would make him feel the least regret. Danny, for his part, personified regret. Danny would resist a change to his airline reservations, even when the change made his life a lot easier, because he imagined the regret he would feel if the change led to some disaster. It's not a stretch to say that Danny anticipating regret. He was perfectly capable of anticipating the regret provoked by events that might never occur and decisions that he might never need to make. Once at a dinner with Amos and their wives, Danny went on at length and with great certainty about his premonition that his son, then still a boy, would one day join the Israeli military, that war would break out, and that his son would be killed. "What were the odds of all that happening?" said Barbara Tversky. "Minuscule, but I couldn't talk him out of it. It was so unpleasant talking with him about these small probabilities that I just gave up." It was as if Danny thought that by anticipating his feelings, he might dull the pain they would inevitably bring. By the end of 1973, Amos and Danny were spending 6 hours a day with each other, either holed up in a conference room or on long walks across Jerusalem. Amos hated smoke. He hated being around people who smoked. Danny was still smoking 2 packs of cigarettes a day, and yet Amos never said a word. All that mattered was the conversation. When they weren't with each other,
They were writing memos to each other to clarify and extend what had been said. If they happened to find themselves at the same social function, they inevitably wound up in the corner of a room, talking to each other. "We just found each other more interesting than anyone else," said Danny, "even if we had just spent the entire day working together." They'd become a single mind, creating ideas about why people did what they did and cooking up odd experiments to test them. For instance, they put this scenario to subjects. You have participated in a lottery at a fair and have bought a single expensive ticket in the hope of winning the single large prize that is offered. The ticket was drawn blindly from a large urn, and its number is 107358. The results of the lottery are now announced, and it turns out that the winning number is 107359. They asked their subjects to rate their unhappiness on a scale from 1 to 20. Then they went to two other groups of subjects and gave them the same scenario, but with one change, the winning number. One group of subjects was told that the winning number was 207358. The second group was told that the winning number was 618379. The first group professed greater unhappiness than the second. Weirdly, but as Dandy and Amos had suspected, the further the winning number was from the number on a person's lottery ticket, the less regret they felt. In defiance of logic, there is a definite sense that one comes closer to winning the lottery when one's ticket number is similar to the number that won, Danny wrote in a memo to Amos, summarizing their data. In another memo, he added that the general point is that the same state of affairs, objectively, can be experienced with very different degrees of misery, depending on how easy it is to imagine that things might have turned out differently. Regret was sufficiently imaginable that people conjured it out of situations they had no control over. But it was, of course, at its most potent when people might have done something to avoid it. What people regretted, and the intensity with which they regretted it, was not obvious. War and politics were never far from Amos and Danny's minds or their conversations. They watched their fellow Israelis closely in the aftermath of the Yom Kippur War. Most regretted that Israel had been caught by surprise. Some regretted that Israel had not attacked first. Few regretted what both Danny and Amos thought they should most regret, the Israeli government's reluctance to give back the territorial gains from the 1967 war. Had Israel given back the Sinai to Egypt, Sadat would quite likely never have felt the need to attack in the first place. Why didn't people regret Israel's inaction? Amos and Danny had a thought. People regretted what they had done and what they wished they hadn't done, far more than what they had not done and perhaps should have. The pain that is experienced when the loss is caused by an act that modified the status quo is significantly greater than the pain that is experienced when the decision led to the retention of the status quo, Danny wrote in a memo to Amos. When one fails to take action that could have avoided a disaster, one does not accept responsibility for the occurrence of the disaster. They set out to build a theory of regret. They were uncovering, or thought they were uncovering, what amounted to the rules of regret. One rule was that the emotion was closely linked to the feeling of coming close and failing. The nearer you came to achieving a thing, the greater the regret you experienced if you failed to achieve it. A second rule, regret was closely linked to feelings of responsibility. The more control you felt you had over the outcome of a gamble, the greater the regret you experienced if the gamble turned out badly. People anticipated regret in Allais' problem not from the failure to win a gamble, but from the decision to forego a certain pile of money. That was another rule of regret. It skewed any decision in which a person faced a choice between a sure thing and a gamble. This tendency was not merely of academic interest. Danny and Amos agreed that there was a real-world equivalent of a sure thing, the status quo. The status quo was what people assumed they would get if they failed to take action. Many instances of prolonged hesitation and of continued reluctance to take positive action should probably be explained in this fashion, wrote Danny to Amos. They played around with the idea that the anticipation of regret might play an even greater role in human affairs than it did if people could somehow know what would have happened if they had chosen differently. The absence of definite information concerning the outcomes of actions one has not taken is probably the single most important factor that keeps regret in life within tolerable bounds, Danny wrote.
We can never be absolutely sure that we would have been happier had we chosen another profession or another spouse. Thus, we are often protected from painful knowledge concerning the quality of our decisions. They spent more than a year working and reworking the same basic idea. In order to explain the paradoxes that expected utility could not explain and create a better theory to predict behavior, you had to inject psychology into the theory. By testing how people choose between various sure gains and gains that were merely probable, they traced the contours of regret. Which of the following two gifts do you prefer? Gift A, a lottery ticket that offers a 50% chance of winning $1,000. Gift B, a certain $400. Or, Gift A, a lottery ticket that offers a 50% chance of winning $1 million. Gift B, a certain $400,000. They collected great heaps of data, choices people had actually made. Always keep one hand firmly on data, Amos liked to say. Data was what set psychology apart from philosophy and physics from metaphysics. In the data, they saw that people's subjective feelings about money had a lot in common with their perceptual experiences. People in total darkness were extremely sensitive to the first glimmer of light, just as people in total silence were alive to the faintest sound, and people in tall buildings were quick to detect even the slightest swaying. As you turned up the lights or the sound or the movement, people became less sensitive to incremental change. So too with money. People felt greater pleasure going from zero to $1 million than they felt going from $1 million to $2 million. Of course, expected utility theory also predicted that people would take a sure gain over a bet that offered an expected value of an even bigger gain. They were risk-averse. But what was this thing that everyone had been calling risk-aversion? It amounted to a fee that people paid, willingly, to avoid regret. A regret premium. Expected utility theory wasn't exactly wrong, it simply did not understand itself, to the point where it could not defend itself against seeming contradictions. The theory's failure to explain people's decisions, Danny and Amos wrote, merely demonstrates what should perhaps be obvious, that non-monetary consequences of decisions cannot be neglected, as they all too often are, in applications of utility theory. Still, it wasn't obvious how to weave what amounted to a collection of insights about an emotion into a theory of how people make risky decisions. They were groping. Amos liked to use an expression he'd read someplace, carving nature at its joint. They were trying to carve human nature at its joint, but the joints of an emotion were elusive. That was one reason Amos didn't particularly like to think or talk about emotion. He didn't like things that were hard to measure. This is indeed a complex theory, Danny confessed one day in a memo. In fact, it consists of several mini-theories which are rather loosely connected. In reading about expected utility theory, Danny had found the paradox that purported to contradict it not terribly puzzling. What puzzled Danny was what the theory had left out. The smartest people in the world are measuring utility, he recalled. As I'm reading about it, something strikes me as really, really peculiar. The theorists seemed to take it to mean the utility of having money. In their minds, it was linked to levels of wealth. More, because it was more, was always better. Less, because it was less, was always worse. This struck Danny as false. He created many scenarios to show just how false it was. Today, Jack and Jill each have a wealth of $5 million. Yesterday, Jack had $1 million and Jill had $9 million. Are they equally happy? Do they have the same utility? Of course they weren't equally happy. Jill was distraught, and Jack was elated. Even if you took $1 million away from Jack and left him with less than Jill, he'd still be happier than she was. In people's perceptions of money, as surely as in their perception of light and sound and the weather and everything else under the sun, what mattered was not the absolute levels, but changes. People making choices, especially choices between gambles for small sums of money, made them in terms of gains and losses. They weren't thinking about absolute levels. I came back to Amos with that question, expecting that he would explain it to me, Danny recalled. Instead, Amos says, "You're right." Chapter 10. The Isolation Effect. It was seldom possible for Amos and Danny to recall where their ideas had come from. They both found it pointless to allocate credit, as their thoughts felt like some alchemical byproduct of their interaction. Yet, on occasion, their origins were preserved. The notion that people making risky decisions were especially sensitive to change pretty clearly had at least started with Danny, but it became seriously valuable only because of what Amos said next. One day toward the end of 1974, as they looked over the gambles they had put to their subjects, Amos asked, "What if we flip the signs?" To that point, the gambles had all involved choices between gains. Would you rather have $500 for sure or a 50-50 shot at $1,000? Now Amos asked, "What about losses?" As in, "Which of the following do you prefer? Gift A, a lottery ticket that offers a 50% chance of losing $1,000? Gift B, a certain loss of $500. It was instantly obvious to them that if you stuck minus signs in front of all these hypothetical gambles and asked people to reconsider them, they behaved very differently than they had when faced with nothing but possible gains. "It was a eureka moment," said Danny. "We immediately felt like fools for not thinking of that question earlier. When you gave a person a choice between a gift of $500 and a 50-50 shot at winning $1,000, he picked the sure thing. Give that same person a choice between losing $500 for sure and a 50-50 risk of losing $1,000, and he took the bet. He became a risk seeker. The odds that people demanded to accept a certain loss over the chance of some greater loss crudely mirrored the odds they demanded to forego a certain gain for the chance of a greater gain. For example, to get people to prefer a 50-50 chance of $1,000 over some certain gain, you had to lower the certain gain to around $370. To get them to prefer a certain loss to a 50-50 chance of losing $1,000, you had to lower the certain loss to around $370. Actually, they soon discovered you had to reduce the amount of the certain loss even further if you wanted to get people to accept it. When choosing between sure things and gambles, people's desire to avoid loss exceeded their desire to secure gain. The desire to avoid loss ran deep, and expressed itself most clearly when the gamble came with the possibility of both loss and gain. That is, when it was like most gambles in life. To get most people to flip a coin for $100, you had to offer them far better than even odds. If they were going to lose $100 if the coin landed on heads, they would need to win $200 if it landed on tails. To get them to flip a coin for $10,000, you had to offer them even better odds than you offered them for flipping it for $100. The greater sensitivity to negative rather than positive changes is not specific to monetary outcomes, wrote Amos and Danny. It reflects a general property of the human organism as a pleasure machine. For most people, the happiness involved in receiving a desirable object is smaller than the unhappiness involved in losing the same object. It wasn't hard to imagine why this might be. A heightened sensitivity to pain was helpful to survival. Happy species endowed with infinite appreciation of pleasures and low sensitivity to pain would probably not survive the evolutionary battle, they wrote. As they sorted through the implications of their new discovery, one thing was instantly clear. Regret had to go, at least as a theory. It might explain why people made seemingly irrational decisions to accept a sure thing over a gamble with a far greater expected value. It could not explain why people facing losses became risk-seeking. Anyone who wanted to argue that regret explains why people prefer a certain $500 to an equal chance to get $0 and $1,000 would never be able to explain why, if you simply subtracted $1,000 from all the numbers and turned the sure thing into a $500 loss, people would prefer the gamble. Amazingly, Danny and Amos did not so much as pause to mourn the loss of a theory they'd spent more than a year working on. The speed with which they simply walked away from their ideas about regret, many of them obviously true and valuable, was incredible. One day, they are creating the rules of regret as if those rules might explain much of how people made risky decisions. The next, they've moved on to explore a more promising theory and don't give regret a second thought. Instead, they set out to determine precisely where and how people responded to the odds of various bets involving both losses and gains. Amos liked to call good ideas raisins. There were three raisins in the new theory. The first was the realization that people responded to changes rather than absolute levels. The second was the discovery that people approach risk very differently when it involved losses than when it involved gains. Exploring people's responses to specific gambles, they found a third reason. People did not respond to probability in a straightforward manner. Amos and Danny already knew from their thinking about regret that in gambles that offered a certain outcome, people would pay dearly for that certainty. Now they saw that people reacted differently to different degrees of uncertainty. When you gave them one bet with a 90% chance of working out and another with a 10% chance of working out, they did not behave as if the first was 9 times as likely to work out as the second. They made some internal adjustment and acted as if a 90% chance was actually slightly less than a 90% chance, and a 10% chance was slightly more than a 10% chance. They responded to probabilities not just with reason, but with emotion. Whatever that emotion was, it became stronger as the odds became more remote. If you told them that there was a 1 in a billion chance that they'd win or lose a bunch of money, they behaved as if the odds were not 1 in a billion, but 1 in 10,000. They feared a 1 in a billion chance of loss more than they should, and attached more hope to a 1 in a billion chance of gain than they should. People's emotional response to extremely long odds led them to reverse their usual taste for risk, and to become risk-seeking when pursuing a long-shot gain, and risk-avoiding when faced with the extremely remote possibility of loss, which is why they bought both lottery tickets and insurance. "If you think about the possibilities at all, you think of them too much," said Danny. "When your daughter is late and you worry, it fills your mind even when you know there is very little to fear. You'd pay more than you should to rid yourself of that worry." People treated all remote probabilities as if they were possibilities. To create a theory that would predict what people actually did when faced with uncertainty, you had to weight the probabilities, in the way that people did, with emotion. Once you did that, you could explain not only why people bought insurance and lottery tickets, you could even explain the Allais paradox. At some point, Danny and Amos became aware that they had a problem on their hands. Their theory explained all sorts of things that expected utility failed to explain, but it implied, as utility theory never had, that it was as easy to get people to take risks as it was to get them to avoid them. All you had to do was present them with a choice that involved a loss. In the more than 200 years since Bernoulli started the discussion, intellectuals had regarded risk-seeking behavior as a curiosity. If risk-seeking was woven into human nature, as Danny and Amos's theory implied that it was, why hadn't people noticed it before? The answer, Amos and Danny now thought, was that intellectuals who studied human decision-making had been looking in the wrong places. Mostly they had been economists who directed their attention to the way people made decisions about money. "It is an ecological fact," wrote Amos and Danny in a draft, "that most decisions in that context, except insurance, involve mainly favorable prospects. The gambles that economists studied were, like most savings and investment decisions, choices between gains. In the domain of gains, people were indeed risk-averse. They took the sure thing over the gamble." Danny and Amos thought that if the theorist had spent less time with money and more time with politics and war, or even marriage, they might have come to different conclusions about human nature. In politics and war, as in fraught human relationships, the choice faced by the decision-maker was often between two unpleasant options. A very different view of man as a decision-maker might well have emerged if the outcomes of decisions in the private, personal, political, or strategic domains had been as easily measurable as monetary gains and losses, they wrote. Danny and Amos spent the first half of 1975 getting their theory into shape so that a rough draft might be shown to other people. They started with the working title Value Theory, but then changed it to Risk Value Theory. For a pair of psychologists who were attacking a theory erected and defended mainly by economists, they wrote with astonishing aggression and confidence. The old theory, they wrote, didn't really even consider how actual human beings grappled with risky decisions. All it did was to explain risky choices solely in terms of attitudes to money or wealth. Between the lines, the reader could detect their giddiness. "Amos and I are in the middle of our most productive period ever," Danny wrote to Paul Slovak in early 1975. "We're developing what appears to us to be a rather complete and quite novel account of choice under uncertainty." The regret treatment has been superseded by a sort of reference level or adaptation level treatment. 6 months later, Danny wrote Slovic that they had a prototype of a new theory of decision making. Amos and I barely managed to finish a paper on risky choice in time to present it to an illustrious group of economists who convene in Jerusalem this week, he wrote. It is still fairly rough. The meeting in question, billed as a conference on public economics, convened in June 1975 at a kibbutz just outside Jerusalem. And so it was on a farm that a theory that would become among the most influential in the history of economics made its public debut. Decision theory was Amos's field, and so Amos did all the talking. The audience contained at least three current and future Nobel Prize winners in economics, Peter Diamond, Daniel McFadden, and Kenneth Arrow. When you listened to Amos, you knew you were talking to a first-rate mind, said Arrow. You raise a question. He's thought of the question already, and he has an answer. After he listened to Amos's presentation, Arrow had one big question for Amos. What is a loss? The theory obviously turned on the stark difference in people's feelings when they face potential losses rather than potential gains. A loss, according to the theory, was when a person wound up worse off than his reference point. But what was this reference point? The easy answer was wherever you started from, your status quo. A loss was just when you ended up worse than your status quo. But how did you determine any person's status quo? In the experiments, it's pretty clear what a loss is, Arrow said later. In the real world, it's not so clear. Wall Street trading desks at the end of each year offer a flavor of the problem. If a Wall Street trader expects to be paid a bonus of $1 million and he's given only $500,000, he feels himself to be, and behaves as if he is, in the domain of losses. His reference point is an expectation of what he would receive. That expectation isn't a stable number. It can be changed in all sorts of ways. A trader who expects to be given a $1 million bonus, and who further expects everyone else on his trading desk to be given $1 million bonuses, will not maintain the same reference point if he learns that everyone else just received $2 million. If he is then paid $1 million, he is back in the domain of losses. Danny would later use the same point to explain the behavior of apes in experiments researchers had conducted on bonobos. If both my neighbor and the next cage and I get a cucumber for doing a great job, that's great. But if he gets a banana and I get a cucumber, I will throw the cucumber at the experimenter's face. The moment one ape got a banana, it became the ape next door's reference point. The reference point was a state of mind. Even in straight gambles, you could shift a person's reference point and make a loss seem like a gain, and vice versa. In so doing, you could manipulate the choices people made simply by the way they were described. They gave the economists a demonstration of the point. Problem A. In addition to whatever you own, you have been given $1,000. You are now required to choose between the following options. Option 1. A 50% chance to win $1,000. Option 2. A gift of $500. Most everyone picked option 2, the sure thing. Problem B. In addition to whatever you own, you have been given $2,000. You are now required to choose between the following options. Option 3, a 50% chance to lose $1,000. Option 4, a sure loss of $500. Most everyone picked option 3, the gamble. The two questions were effectively identical. In both cases, if you picked the gamble, you wound up with a 50-50 shot at being worth $2,000. In both cases, if you picked the sure thing, you wound up being worth $1,500. But when you framed the sure thing as a loss, people chose the gamble. When you framed it as a gain, people picked the sure thing. The reference point, the point that enabled you to distinguish between a gain and a loss, wasn't some fixed number. It was a psychological state. What constitutes a gain or a loss depends on the representation of the problem and on the context in which it arises, the first draft of value theory rather loosely explained. We propose that the present theory applies to the gains and losses as perceived by the subject. Danny and Amos were trying to show that people faced with a risky choice failed to put it in context. They evaluated it in isolation. In exploring what they now called the isolation effect, Amos and Danny had stumbled upon another idea, and its real-world implications were difficult to ignore. This one they called framing. Simply by changing the description of a situation and making a gain seem like a loss, you could cause people to completely flip their attitude toward risk and turn them from risk-avoiding to risk-seeking. "We invented framing without realizing we were inventing framing," said Danny. "You take two things that should be identical, the way they differ should be irrelevant, and by showing it isn't irrelevant, you show that expected utility theory is wrong." Framing, to Danny, felt like their work on judgment. "Here, look, yet another strange trick the mind played on itself." Framing was just another phenomenon. There was never going to be a theory of framing, but Amos and Danny would eventually spend all kinds of time and energy dreaming up examples of the phenomenon to illustrate how it might distort real-world decisions. The most famous was the Asian disease problem. The Asian disease problem was actually two problems, which they gave separately to two different groups of subjects innocent of the power of framing. The first group got this problem. Problem 1. Imagine that the U.S. is preparing for the outbreak of an unusual Asian disease, which is expected to kill 600 people. Two alternative programs to combat the disease have been proposed. Assume that the exact scientific estimate of the consequence of the programs is as follows. If Program A is adopted, 200 people will be saved. If Program B is adopted, there is a one-third probability that 600 people will be saved and a two-thirds probability that no people will be saved. Which of the two programs would you favor? An overwhelming majority chose Program A and saved 200 lives with certainty. The second group got the same setup, but with a choice between two other programs. If Program C is adopted, 400 people will die. If Program D is adopted, there is a one-third probability that nobody will die and a two-thirds probability that 600 people will die. When the choice was framed this way, an overwhelmingly majority chose Program D. The two problems were identical, but in the first case, when the choice was framed as a gain, the subjects elected to save 200 people for sure, which meant that 400 people would die for sure, though the subjects weren't thinking of it that way. In the second case, with the choice framed as a loss, they did the reverse and ran the risk that they'd kill everyone. People did not choose between things. They chose between descriptions of things. Economists and anyone else who wanted to believe that human beings were rational could rationalize or try to rationalize loss aversion. But how did you rationalize this? Economists assumed that you could simply measure what people wanted from what they chose. But what if what you want changes with the context in which the options are offered to you? It was a funny point to make because the point within psychology would have been banal, the psychologist Richard Nisbet later said. Of course, we were affected by how the decision is presented. After the meeting between the American economists and the Israeli psychologists on the Jerusalem kibbutz, the economists returned to the United States and Amos sent a letter to Paul Slovic. "Everything considered, we got a very favorable response," he wrote. Somehow, the economists felt that we are right, and at the same time they wished we weren't, because the replacement of utility theory by the model we outlined would cause them no end of problems. There was at least one economist who didn't feel that way, but he wasn't, at least when he came upon Danny and Amos's theory, anyone's idea of a future Nobel Prize winner. His name was Richard Thaler. In 1975, Thaler was a 30-year-old assistant professor in the School of Management at the University of Rochester with vague prospects. It was a wonder he was even there. He had two deeply pronounced traits that rendered him unsuited not just to economics, but to academic life. The first was that he was easily bored and highly imaginative in his attempts to escape boredom. As a child, he routinely changed the rules of games he was expected to play. The first hour and a half of Monopoly, when players march around the board randomly, landing on properties and buying them, he found tedious. After playing a few times, he announced, "This is a stupid game." He said that he would only play if all the properties were shuffled and dealt to the players at the start of the game. Same with Scrabble. Finding it boring when he got dealt five E's and no high-value consonants, he changed the rules so that the letters were organized into three buckets: vowels, common consonants, and rare high-value consonants. Each player got the same number of each. After seven rounds, each player was given a high-value consonant. All the changes Thaler made to the games he played as a kid reduced the waiting around time and the roll of luck and increased the challenge and, usually, the player's competitiveness. This was odd, as Thaler's other pronounced trait was a sense of ineptitude.